It's great to have all of you here this morning. Thank you so much for being a part of our worship service. Pray that you are doing well and you are staying safe, and we are looking forward to that time in the not too distant future. We're hoping somewhere around June, maybe June 14th, to be able to do some sort of thing here at the church. And so please stay tuned. Make sure that you always check your emails. And I always send out texts at least 3 or 4 times a week, just to keep everybody informed or to encourage you in some way. So please, when I send those, make sure that you read them. They only take a minute, and it can be helpful and informative, as well as the emails that Aaron sends out, which are great. He does a phenomenal job with that, very informative. So please make sure you consult those as well. So as we begin to build towards opening back up, we're looking forward to that. And we'll make sure too that we will have the right kind of accommodations as well. So we're giving that a lot of thought, just in case you were wondering. So, as many of you know, I've been doing this series on the 7 great I am statements of Jesus in the Gospel of John. And there are 7. And for the most part, I've spent 2 weeks on each of the great I am statements, except for the I am statement, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And what I've done is I've broken each of those down. I am the way, and I've spent, I think, 2 Sundays on that. And I am the truth, and this will be the 2nd Sunday on I am the truth. And then down the road, I will be spending some time on I am the life. But I think on this particular statement, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and this clause, I am the truth, I'm going to be spending 3 Sundays. So 2 Sundays ago, Mother's Day, then this Sunday, and then I think next Sunday. I think that relevant and that important. So if you want to, you can go back and catch up if you haven't been with us during this process. But I think you might find it to be helpful. So when we look at this particular I am statement, I am the way, the truth, and the life, it is what I would consider to be one of the most important statements throughout the entire New Testament, let alone the book of John. And the I am the truth statement within this particular part of the passage, in many ways, it's probably the most relevant, the most important portion of that text that we could be talking about today. So that's why I'm spending so much time on it. It's kind of easy to get lost in all of that, and I don't want us to get lost, but it's that important. So let's go ahead and turn to John 14, verses 1 through 7, if you like, and we will pick it up there again. Jesus is with his disciples. He's already done the triumphal entry. He's been teaching in the temple courts. Now he's meeting with his disciples. He's alluding to the fact that he's going to give up his life, and that when he does, he's going to go to heaven and prepare a place for them. And so he says this within that context. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the place. You know the way to the place where I am going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you are going, so how can we know the way? Jesus answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. It's interesting, sometimes when we say that text, we just say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I mean, in a certain sense, Jesus doubles down on each of these clauses. So it's not to the exclusion of in any way. He says, I am the way and the truth and the life. So there's this triumvirate thing that's taking place here, all of which live and exist and hold in balance and attention with each other. So this is a very dense statement that he makes about himself. Verse 7, if you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. So then he goes on to say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So as I've stated here many times, and I want to underscore again, this is the core biblical principle and text, the hill upon which all of Christendom and the Christian must be willing to live and even to die. It is the core. I mean, it is probably one of the most succinct statements that Jesus makes about himself, that is the most accurate, the most powerful, the most descriptive statement that describes who he is and what he is about and what our response ought to be in relationship to that. So, with that in mind then, there's no more of a contentious cultural battle today between the church and the rest of the world than what it means for Jesus to be the truth and for Christians to imitate and to follow that truth. And it is a highly contentious battle today. And it's interesting because for those of us who are Christians and who hold to this and who hold to this claim about Jesus, I mean, for many people, we would be described as being insensitive, offensive, and even hateful among some people. It might be described as that kind of a thing. And so I'm going to talk a bit more about this later on in terms of what this really looks like. So when Jesus describes himself as the truth, then what he's really saying is that he is what the actual reality, that the truth is the actual reality and existence in life. And it's everything that is derived from that and what we act upon. So that we understand, because there are some people who may not have had this exposure before, because what you're hearing maybe in secondary education or in higher education, when we talk about truth within those settings, what I'm about to say is not what you hear, but this is what we have believed for 4,000 years in the Judeo-Christian worldview. Within the Christian worldview, this is what we have believed for 2,000 years. This is something that we cannot negotiate away when it comes to the truth, and that is this, that our historical understanding of truth is that it is universal, that it applies to everyone, that it is absolute. If you can move on to the next slide, please. Yep. That is, keep going. Keep going. Sorry, Austin, it's the historical understanding of truth. That it is universal, that it is absolute, that it is the standard for everything by which everything else is measured by, and that it is eternal. It never changes. God does not change. Who he is, he has always been that way. He has always been that way. And so with globalism as the primary vehicle in recent history, Western civilization has moved from the idea of the truth to the understanding that it's a truth. Next slide, please. From the truth to a truth. You know what? Just go ahead and kill the slides, because I think maybe I got the wrong one may have been sent to you. I'm not sure. But so we'll just go with my notes here. So let me say it again. With globalization as a vehicle, Western civilization has moved from the truth to a truth. And that's how we believe, that's how we act as a Western civilization. But Christians believe that Jesus is the clearest manifestation of truth in terms of what really is, in terms of what ought to be. In fact, John describes Jesus in John 14 in this way. So if you turn to your Bibles, John 1:14, it says this: "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." Full of grace and truth. So, just backing up a little bit on this particular text, where John says, the Word, many of you know that word to mean, to say, that is the Greek word, logos. The word logos means divine reason. That he is the divine reason or truth. He is the essence of truth. So the Word, the divine reason, became flesh and made his dwelling among us. The very essence of truth became flesh, who came from the Father and who is full of grace and truth. Now, I just want to drill down on this, the latter part of this clause here in verse 14, because what we tend to do in our thinking, not just within Christendom, but in our thinking as a whole, is we are reductionists by nature. And so rather than holding things in tension and seeing the fullness of the truth or the fullness of a particular reality, we reduce it to something that's much easier to access and to act upon. So even within the Christian faith then, many times what happens is that we reduce Jesus to grace or we reduce Jesus to truth. But the text here reads that he is grace and truth. So currently within much of the church today, there's been this massive shift from, say, like the 1980s, when the focus was all about truth, to the focus now being all about grace, aside and independently of truth. So in much of the church today, people don't know what to do with the Apostle Paul because he talks a lot about truth. People don't know what to do with the Gospel of John. In fact, there are some mainline churches that will not allow the Gospel of John to be read in that church because they don't like how John talks about the truth. It's offensive to them. So they won't have it read. But when I read this text here, I read a text that says that Jesus is both of these and that these two things live in tension with each other. That sometimes when we engage in grace and being gracious to other people, it may mean that we really have to search and work hard to figure out what is the best possible and most truthful way that we can really help them. And sometimes when we want to tell people about the truth, it may sound as if we're not being very gracious. But these two things must live in tension with each other. Now, to understand Jesus' truth is to understand what his attributes are, who he is. So we know that he is love and he is goodness. He is holiness and justice. And we know that he is also truth. But we also know that Jesus is the law. And he describes himself in that kind of a way. In fact, in Matthew 5, verses 17 through 19, he says this. He says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law of the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven." So when we talk about Jesus as grace and Jesus as truth, There's a temptation for some people to reduce it to, in such a way that Jesus is only grace and he is not truth, and therefore the law as it relates to the truth of God is no longer as relevant. But that's not what this says. And it's these kinds of things that put us at odds with much of the world, because they just want us to embrace the part of Jesus that says, love your neighbor as yourself. Not obey God in terms of what he has commanded you to do. But that's not what the text reads. And because it doesn't read that way, then we can't be that way. So we must not only submit ourselves to these truths, but we must embody them as well. We must, in fact, become like, when we become like Christ, we become like his truth. So to imitate Jesus in all of his truth is oftentimes to place us at odds with those that we know within the world. Sometimes it places us at odds with our family. It has me in my past. Sometimes it places us at odds with our friends. I am astounded over the course of my life, of all the people I've known and over the time that I've known them, how many times we have diverged and gone in different directions because I want to live as much as possible, although not perfectly, but I want to live according to God's truth. And so there are times when my friends just say, look, I can't hang with you there. And so we part ways. Many times it's not acrimonious or anything like that. It's just that they just can't come to terms with certain truths of God that I want to be a part of my life. It's too painful for them. And it might be too painful for you. Sometimes we have colleagues that we work with in the workplace, and everything's fine. We work well together for a long time, and then they find out that we're a believer or something like that, and then things change. Right? And you're like, what happened to you? Well, no, I'm the same person. You know, yeah, but you believe these things. Yeah, I do. Well, you can't believe those things. Well, why not? See, sometimes that happens. The truth that we embrace, the truth that we become like Christ, puts us at odds with our colleagues. Sometimes it puts us at odds with our neighbors. I have a couple of neighbors whom I've said hello. I'm new neighbors. I've lived there for about a year and a half, that I've said hello to in passing. And, you know, as neighborhoods go, people talk about who's new and what they do and all that kind of stuff. They know that I'm a pastor. And their behavior has changed towards me because they found out I'm a pastor. They have certain stereotypes, right? So they dismiss me because I'm a pastor. Because they don't like the truth, or maybe they don't like the stereotypes that, you know, that they think that make up who I am. So Jesus once said that any man who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is not worthy of the kingdom of God. That when we follow Jesus, he's going to take us places that sometimes other people can't approve of or agree with. And if we regret that and we look back and we wish that we had all of that back again and that we're willing to consider all that again, then we might not be worthy of the kingdom. That Jesus is worth us giving all that up. No man, he says, who isn't willing to give up his father, his mother, his brothers, his sisters, and yes, even his own life, and take up his cross and follow me, is worthy of the kingdom of God. So Jesus says, look, I am the kind of truth that is worth your willingness to give all that up if you have to. So with that in mind, then, it's important for us to know that at every possible level in our existence, humanity struggles mightily with engaging truth, with what truth is. Because truth demands that we comport our lives to it. But most people want to take a version of a truth and use it to comport other things to them. Does this make sense to you all? Truth demands that we comport our lives to it. But what most people want to do is take a truth and bend it and mold it and use it in such a way that they can make others comport to them. That's how we do it. So, what God calls us to is to have a spirit of truth as it relates to Christ. But what much of the world does is they have the spirit of Pilate. You will remember that when Jesus was arrested and he was taken before the Sanhedrin, and then he was taken before Pilate and the Sanhedrin and then Pilate. And so towards the end of the interview with Pilate, Jesus says this. He says, "The reason why I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of the truth listens to me." Now, I honestly think that Jesus was trying to preach the gospel to Pilate. I honestly think that Jesus was saying to Pilate, "Look, I am the truth. And anybody who's on the side of the truth listens to me." I mean, this is how important that particular word and concept is. What was Pilate's response? Well, John records, Pilate says, "What is truth?" He retorted. And so I think that within our world today, many people are like, "Well, what is truth? Truth is what I make it. Truth is what I want something to be. Truth is my ability to bend the reality in such a way that it serves me, rather than me having to bend myself to particular realities that I may not like, but may be, in fact, what is best for me." So by way of example, and years ago I've used this particular example here. When I was a professor at Geneva College, I was attending Christ Church at Grove Farm, and I was the youth minister there, and I was teaching Sunday school. I was one of the youth ministers there, and I was teaching Sunday school. And so we had a group of college students from Geneva, and we had a group of college students from Carnegie Mellon University. And it was a large Sunday school class. I would say there were 50 or 60 young adults there. And I was talking on the Psalms, and I forget what particular psalm I was teaching on, but as I was teaching, the psalm was referenced about God's truth. And I had a whiteboard, and on the whiteboard was a red marker and a blue marker. And as I was writing, I said with my blue marker in hand, I said, in this group of students behind me, I said, "Can you believe it that we live in a world today that even as I'm writing on this whiteboard with a blue marker, that if somebody in the audience wanted to say, 'Well, that's not a blue marker, that's a red marker. I know you call it a blue marker. I know historically it's been referenced as a blue marker, but for me, I would rather call it a red marker.'" And I turned around and looked, and I kid you not, all of the Carnegie Mellon students were like nodding their head, "Well, that seems appropriate to me." And all the Geneva College students were going like, they were just doing that. Like, "That's the craziest thing I ever saw in my life or heard." And I was dumbfounded because, Carnegie Mellon University in the world of technology is almost like second to none. In the world of the arts is almost second to none. It is a very good school. And so you would expect more in the way of critical thinking, at least from those students. I don't know if those students still think that way, but at least that group of students did. So I looked at one of the students, one of them that I'd known, a young woman, and I said, "Do you think that's true?" And she said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, okay." I said, May I borrow from you a $20 bill? I didn't ask any of the Geneva College students because I knew that wouldn't be a possibility. But the Carnegie Mellon students, I said, I knew that was more likely that might be a possibility. So I said, may I borrow from you a $20 bill? And she said, sure. So she opened her wallet, and there was a bunch of $20 bills in there. So she pulled one out, and she gave it to me and put it in my hand. And I said, look, I know that I use the word borrow. And I know that you know what borrow means, but I really choose to interpret the word borrow as keep. So I'm going to keep your $20 bill. So she looked shocked at first. And I said, do you see what I'm saying? We just don't get to redefine what things mean because it's convenient to us, because someone's going to pay a penalty, right? Because it matters, right? So in any case, we live in this world where people want to be able to say, you know, this morning I think I'll be a female. Not sure how I'll feel about it tomorrow morning, but maybe tomorrow morning I'll decide to be a male, or maybe I'll decide to be trans, or whatever. So I remember also years ago, one of my colleagues at Geneva talking about, he was involved in the doctoral program at Geneva, and he was talking to one of his professors about his dissertation. And the professor brought up about another student, doctoral student, this was at Pitt University, another doctoral student who wanted to do a dissertation, and they were sort of trying to figure out what to do the dissertation on. So the other doctoral student, my colleague said, proposed that she write a dissertation, a doctoral dissertation, on her life, on her own life. Now, I just got to tell you that most of the time when you do a doctoral dissertation, you are doing a vertical study on something that has some kind of significance, large significance, in terms of what it did in the world. So the advisor of my colleague said to this other student, well, I don't think it would be appropriate for you to do a dissertation on your life because there's the question of significance. And the student shot back, who are you to say whether my life is significant or not? Whether or not it's had some kind of measurable impact upon the world. And so you know what? They let her do her dissertation on her life. I mean, that's how relevant, how relative we have become as a culture. I don't know where it went from there, but that was the argument. And a university let her do it. So there are four principles then regarding truth in our life and world that I want to get to before we're done with this particular part of I Am the Way, the Truth, and the Life. And the first is this. And Austin, I don't know if you can find this. Maybe this might be further on down the line. You can look for it. But this is number one. This is the first principle. Deception is a spiritual and physical, existential and foundational reality. So deception is a spiritual thing. Deception is a physical thing, and it exists, and it is a foundational reality that must always be accounted for. Deception is a spiritual and physical, existential and foundational reality that must always be accounted for. The second most powerful being, this is what we believe, the second most powerful being in all of reality specializes in deception and has devoted himself to destroying the truth and to deceive us for our destruction. This is what we believe, but it's what most of us forget. And we do it to our detriment by forgetting that every day forces are at work in our life to deceive us away from the truth. So what I mean by that then is I'm talking about Satan and deceit. Satan exists as the opposite of truth. He exists in opposition to the truth. So if you want to turn to your Bibles in Daniel 8:25, it's this fascinating passage here as I was doing my study, Daniel 8:25, where it reads, "He," and this is a reference to Satan, "he will cause deceit to prosper." He will cause deceit to prosper. What a fully loaded word that is. Deceit to prosper, not only for it to become more abundant, but for prosperity even to come from deceit. I think you could kind of read that in there. "And he," that is Satan, "will consider himself superior when they," that is us, "when they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the prince of princes," that is Christ. "Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power." He will be destroyed by Christ. "But he will cause deceit to prosper." Look, honestly, have we ever lived in a time when there has been more in the way of misinformation? So misinformation isn't no information. Misinformation isn't mistaken information. Misinformation is when you choose to misinform. You corrupt the truth because you have some other agenda. So there's just enough truth there for it to seem to be credible, but there's enough truth not there to get what you want and maybe to harm or to hurt others. "He will cause deceit to prosper. He will consider himself superior," which Satan does, "over God, when they feel secure." Do we not live in a world where most people feel utterly, completely deluded about how secure they really are? How confident they are in what they... I mean, one of the most profound things that somebody said to me about 10 or 15 years ago was this: "They don't know what they don't know. They don't know what they don't know." And we have too many people who don't know what they don't know, and they feel secure in not knowing what they don't know. Does this make sense, everybody? So, this is a text for our time. It is a text for our time. Here's another one where Jesus is commenting on the source of deception while addressing the lies and corruption of the Pharisees. He says this in John 8:44. So again, we're in the Gospel of John. John 8:44. Jesus says this to the Pharisees. He says, "You are of your father the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies." This person here has devoted to the remainder of his existence to trying to destroy whatever truth he can, and to lie and to misinform. Every temptation that you have ever experienced in your life, whatever that temptation was, whatever temptation you still have in your life right now, is predicated on a lie. It's predicated on misinformation. It's predicated on the corruption of some kind of truth. If you want to know in part how to deal with certain temptations that you have in your life, get at the lie that's behind that temptation. and see it as a lie, because that's what it is. So Jesus then is talking about this entity, this person, who exists in opposition to him, who has access to the world in which we live. And his work is to destroy and to corrupt whatever truth he possibly can. So going back to that principle that I said, the first principle that I said was, deception is a spiritual and physical, existential and foundational reality that must always be accounted for. Every morning that you wake up and that I wake up, it would not be a bad thing to ask us this question. In what way am I susceptible to being deceived today? In what way is deception at work in my life, in my family, at the work that I do, in terms of how I see myself, my values, my behavior, my thoughts? How is deception playing itself out and working against the truth of God in my life? It would not be a bad thing to do that, because it is a foundational reality for everybody that's here and that's listening. It lives and it exists in opposition to Jesus as the truth. It lives and it exists in opposition to the attributes of God. And they are always at work. They are always being questioned. And so I would say then that it would be a very helpful and a very healthy reminder to understand that deception is a foundational existential reality in everyone's life. Now, I see that it's almost 25 after. I have three more principles to unpack. There's no way that I can do that in a timely fashion that would do justice to what I think those principles are. So I'm going to push this off until next Sunday. I hope that you join us next Sunday. Every pastor wants to think this, but I'll just go ahead and say it. I think the subject matter that I am talking about is among the most relevant and the most important that you could possibly hear. I know there are other pastors who have a lot of wonderful things to say, so if you're tuned into them at some point, that's great. But I would ask you to tune into this, because I think that not only is it relevant in terms of our own personal lives, but it is becoming increasingly more poignant, more powerful, more relevant in the world in which we live. It would explain so much of what you and I are sensing and feeling in the culture in which we find ourselves living. So I hope that you will join us next week. So I'll unpack the other three. It's probably all the time I will have, and then I'll have to push truth out one more Sunday probably and finish it, because that particular Sunday, I really want to talk about truth and the culture. How do we understand truth existentially within the culture in which we live? What are the forces, the ideological, philosophical, worldview forces that are at work against the truth of God today?